Welcome to Emotional Sobriety. We took a week off. Now we're all in the midst of our national, or we're either in the midst or we're coming out of our national hangover post-election. And I'm really happy to, be back and talking about this stuff, talking about recovery, emotional sobriety, because the clock doesn't stop just because, whatever the existential national narrative is, we got to wake up every day and put on our boots one leg at a time and get back on the trail. So anyway, we've got Herb K with us, Alan and Tom, and Alan is going to get us started by pitching us the theme. So good morning, Alan.
Well, good morning, and welcome everyone to our podcast on emotional sobriety. It's great to have Herb join us today. Herb, welcome to the podcast. I thought it would be a good idea, since the three of us have been, immersed in discussing, thinking about, reflecting on, expanding our consciousness about emotional sobriety, that we each of us share how our thinking has evolved through these years. And, this is a great time to do that. For a lot of us in this country right now, we're challenged with what just happened. And some of the principles that you were talking about earlier before we started recording apply to emotional sobriety here. It's like, how do we stay centered and deal with the reality of what's going on? So anyway, I think that would be a great topic for today, Patrick.
Right. And I wanted to say, we're either challenged by what just happened or we're ecstatic about what just happened. Well, and either way,
that's right. Because that's what you're saying. Some people aren't hungover. I was thinking that when you said it. Some people are celebrating that. They're very excited about what some of the possibilities are.
Well, I'm new to this particular foursome. I'm on this particular venue. And so I just been involved with this foursome for 2 or 3 years on the panel for emotional sobriety. And I want to say it's been the whipped cream on top of the sundae, but actually that would make it not really substantial or nutritional. And it's been much more substantial and nutritional than just the whipped cream. So it's just another layer of richness unpacking the journey that I've been on for most of my life, I guess. And just a quick thumbnail, I was introduced to some form of spirituality, traditional Catholicism, by a mother who was a daily Catholic and taught how to pray and the value of it and the reality of God. And so for some reason, I connected to it, just like a magnet to iron. And eventually, for lots of different reasons, none of them good, went into a monastery to become a Catholic priest for 7 years. And then that didn't work. So I came out and wanted to be a psychologist for 5 years, and that didn't work. Stories for a different day. And then I got into self-development as well as the corporate climb. And that worked. That really worked. Until it didn't. And I got into therapy because my life wasn't working. That's where I met Alan Berger, coincidentally with recovery from alcoholism. He was the clinical director at the program that my wife was introduced to and that I came in through the back door. That's the Reader's Digest version. And I started a journey in recovery right in there someplace. And I'll address, I don't want to set off any fireworks, but I'll address some of the comments that were made because I think it was recorded in the initial part. When I came out of the monastery after 7 years of silence, having a graduate education in philosophy and theology, and completely clueless. I was given a book by Ayn Rand, Fountainhead, and then I read her second book, Atlas Shrugged. And that formed my attitude and my opinion in my philosophy toward life and toward personal responsibility. I hadn't thought about that, Alan, until you mentioned how we're going to start today. And that's what I really got the sense of personal responsibility at the philosophical level, certainly not at the personal level. And then built my approach to psychology in my pursuit of a graduate education there, as well as the exposure to and experience with therapy going along with that, and then meeting you and then introducing you to Richard Rohr and combining the 12-step program, the background I had in theology, and the background you have in psychology. And it just was alchemy is a good word for what happened. There's no formula for it, except that it is just what happened. The goal of our relationship, both the therapeutic and the friendship, now are co-facilitating. And about 20 years ago, you, I believe, began pioneering the letter and unpacking that and asking me to work with you on that. And
might be 20 years ago, actually.
Right? Yeah.
In the first workshop, 2 days.
Yeah. And it became very clear from both my 12-step work and then from the balance that you bring from the psychological understanding of human development about balance. And it was really so many different contributions to my understanding of both human biology in terms of the role of the cortex to manage the limbic system and the biological system, literally at that level, at physiology, that's how we're built. This is how, if you want to develop to be, I'll use some of your words, an optimal human being, a balanced, wholesome human being, we use the thing that makes us human, our mind, and our will functions in the cortex to manage the rascals of the limbic system and the instinct. It's that process that people can find through religion and or through education and through a good relationship. But I have found it. I've been a seeker all my life until I was about 5 years sober, and then found the steps, a methodology called a way of life. That's what we're talking about, a way of life. The Buddhists call their practice a way of life. It's not even a religion. They don't believe in I'm a dilettante Buddhist. They don't believe in a supreme being. They believe in supreme consciousness. Okay. The words are all going to be a little different, but the underneath is really, really going to be the same, because we're talking about human beings and the human dynamic of growth. And you hold up in your PowerPoint an acorn, and then you hold up a PowerPoint of an oak tree. What is the organismic life force that makes that acorn break open to become that oak tree? And it's so powerful a metaphor for emotional sobriety. This is a normal organic growth given the right circumstances and nutrients and all the rest of that. But in our case, it's about consciousness and choice. We need to know better in order to do better. Sometimes we need to do better in order to know better. It's a dynamic, and there's no one way. And that's the nice part about, from my standpoint, the 12-step way of life and process. We don't have a theology, and we don't have a dogma about how to live life. We have some suggestions as to how to maximize our consciousness and how to maximize our contribution. I mentioned in our panel the other day, the formula for happiness, that his name will come back to me. He just really summarizes so well. Anybody who wants to be happy, I mean, everybody wants to be happy, and everybody defines it differently, but everybody wants to be happy. He said, anybody who wants to be happy, and that's their goal, will never be happy, because happiness is not a product. It's a byproduct. It's a byproduct of my relationship with life, that is having meaning and purpose, internally driven, not externally mandated, something inside of me, a purpose and a meaning, whatever it is, it doesn't make any difference. And the second part is, and a contribution to humanity. So internally to me, my own, you call it the center of gravity deep inside myself, so that I'm not placing my sense of value or esteem outside myself in people or circumstances or events. I'm defining it internally in my ability to respond to people, circumstances, and events. And as the result of the growth of that, I contribute to the people around me. In my case, because of the 12-step process, I have reduced, eliminated, mostly managed my suffering to a place where my life flourishes. I have a formula that I know works, and I'm passionate about it. At 85 years old, I'm on fire in a way that I've never been on fire, and that fire continues to grow. It's contained, well, by my standards, it's contained in these forms like this, where we can manifest and help other people identify a way of life and some techniques and some experiences that will help them identify the sources of their suffering and the resources of their healing. As you could probably tell, press my button and I can go. I'm going to stop there and take a breath so that you guys can also contribute. Although if you all want to be silent, I'll go ahead.
Boom. Mic drop.
I realize I had been talking using the metaphor. I think I've heard you talk about it, Herb, the two sides of one coin. The two sides of one coin is self-compassion, and then the other is personal responsibility. I was working with a lot of people, including myself, that basically we were just trying to get happy, like you're talking about, Herb. It was very selfish. You have to focus on self, but it was a very selfish thing. And we weren't taking the next step, which was, you know, why are we doing this? And why we're doing this, hopefully, is we want to repair ourselves, recover ourselves, and rejoin the world or join it for the first time in a way that we can contribute. And this is, to me, a part of the essence of emotional sobriety. At the end of the day, if I have not abandoned myself, which I've spent many years doing, if I can just say I expressed and acted with kindness to other people, then that's a good day. So I can be feeling like shit. I can be depressed. I can be upset about something. One of my groups helped me understand this, the difference between feeling good and doing good. And I asked this one woman at the beginning of the session, how are you doing? She said, are you asking me how I'm doing or how I'm feeling? And then she went on to say, I'm doing great, you know, and she described the behavioral stuff she was doing, the hard work she was doing in this stuff. And we know, as addicts, we know this stuff, doing that stuff. And then she punctuated it by saying, and I feel like shit.
She was there at a workshop?
She was in one of my eating disorder groups.
You should have been in her group.
Any of you guys down the groups, in that moment, I was in her group. So it's everybody's workshop. The Patch Adams said everybody's a doctor and everybody's a patient. Emotional sobriety, it's been a way of focusing this stuff that's been all through my life and all through my recovery. It's becoming more organized, and it's a way of, and the more I can understand it in these terms, the better job I can do in teaching it to other people.
One of the evidences of that, I believe, is the magic between Dr. Berger and myself that we discovered 20, 25 years ago in doing a panel together. We were asked questions by the audience and never had done that before, sitting next to one another. Mm-hmm. And then we began a dialogue between ourselves based on the conversation with the audience. And neither one of us was defended. Neither one of us needed to be right. We were there just to complement one another in terms of our understanding and experience. We didn't know it at the time, but at the end of that particular panel, we just looked at each other and it was like a magic moment. And yeah. From there, we began co-facilitating workshops because that's the emotional sobriety. We had it, or at least we began to, and then we were able to put concepts and words to it as we actually studied it.
Alan, you have a good influence on a lot of us.
Well, let me share some of my perspective on this evolution of my thought about emotional sobriety. You know, you guys tied it very much into your personal and professional development, which is right on. That's, I think, a testament to the power of what we're talking about. If it makes sense, then it becomes a guiding force in our life. And that's what you're both describing, is that there's been an unfolding of your consciousness, of your maturity, of your perspective, and it's very different and much richer and more differentiated today than it was a decade ago, than it was 2 decades ago, 3 decades ago. And I've experienced that same thing, is that there's something about the process that we're engaged in, is that once it starts, it's like that acorn and oak tree, man. You just start growing. I mean, it's just, and if you get in the way of it, you're reminded. You know what? It's you're on the wrong path, buddy. Get beautiful, back over beautiful. Here. Right? You're out of here. And the path is over here. And that's kind of the, you know, Herb and I talk about our emotions as signaling systems. That, hey, something, we're off. We're off our path. You know, how do we get back to the path? Emotional sobriety, for me, has been about getting back to the path.
Yeah.
Right? Getting back there. It really does promote an emotional resilience like nothing else that I've seen. And, you know, I'm exposed to a lot of different ideas and psychology and stuff. And I still am very much a strong believer in that the 12 steps harness and have captured an incredibly powerful psychological force and process that is, like, you know, you talk about, Herb, it's so methodical, right? It is a solid method of changing your, transforming your life. And we see it. We see it over and over again. And then when we discovered emotional sobriety, it took that transformation to another level to me. It really felt like I was rocketing into the fourth dimension. I heard that term before. I thought it was just that I was sober and trying to live a sober life. But I realized today that was a very, very simplistic understanding of it based on my experience. And when I started to understand this whole range of possibilities that are discovered when we find that treasure chest of emotional sobriety, it really rocketed my recovery. It kind of was a breath of fresh air in it, to tell you the truth. And not to say that the things that I discovered were, hey, yeah, let's celebrate. Some of the stuff was hard to look at. You know, to realize the extent, even after the amount of sobriety I had, that I was still emotionally dependent, was in one sense kind of shocking, but also made me realize that if we don't focus on this, it doesn't just happen. We need, you know, I needed to become aware of some of these issues and really start to look at the impact my emotional dependency has and has had on my entire life. And most importantly, in terms of the impact it has today, and in terms of trying to start growing myself and starting to mature, which that to me was such a shift in my consciousness. And it really got captured in that saying that I'm okay if consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. And I love your addition to that, Tom. Last time you say the other side of that coin would be, I'm okay if this didn't happen.
Right.
If this didn't happen, I'd be okay. And the other side is, I'm okay if, right? Mm-hmm. This goes my way. You put, I'm okay if this didn't happen. Right on. Mm-hmm. That's, I could see that, embrace it. It echoed deep inside my soul and in my recovery, the consciousness of that. And I see today, you know, how that made it very difficult for me to progress in terms of emotional maturity. and becoming more able to cope with life on life's terms. And, you know, what are the things that I realize is that it's not about that we get in a place where nothing bothers us. It's that we learn to deal with what bothers us. I'm always going to be affected by what's going on around me. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. My relationship to my world, my environment, is an important thing, right? It provides a lot of sustenance, growth, and all that, just like oxygen. If you take it away, we're in trouble. The same thing, relationships, you take them away. But just like with oxygen, I have to be responsible to take it in, to inhale it, process it, and then blow off the carbon dioxide that I don't need after I process the oxygen. That's my responsibility in terms of my relationship with life. Well, I think that's a metaphor. It's a metaphor for everything. It's how I am connected to my reality that's going to determine my happiness through, you know, using that term, Herb, my well-being, my peace of mind, my serenity, whatever term you want to put in there. And I see that now. So I think, you know, one of the things I've heard you talk about, Tom, which I've always appreciated in your work, is the importance of helping people become aware of how they've disempowered themselves by becoming a victim. Oh, yeah. And I never realized the extent of my disempowerment by looking to my environment for support instead of figuring out how to provide that support myself. Now, that doesn't mean I don't need it. I'll call Herb up or I'll call you up if I'm in a bad place and I'll reach out and I'll say, hey. But I take the responsibility to reach out. Number one, say, hey, you got a minute to talk. Number two, I take what you're saying and I try it on. I see if it has some relevance and some utility and can help me take the next step towards coping with whatever is going on. And that's, you know, we talk about what's going on right now in our world in the election. And like, you know, we've noted is that the country is almost split down the middle. Some people are celebrating right now. Other people are mourning and grieving and dreading, you know, what's going to happen in the next 4 years. You know, I had my reaction to it, but after a couple of days, I said, okay, well, here it is, another opportunity. How am I going to plug in all the stuff we've been talking about, try to stay centered, back to the serenity prayer. I've been saying that a lot, right? What can I influence? What can I influence? And, you know, what I can do is try to have an open mind. Let's see what happens. Our democracy, just like our recovery, is an experiment. We don't know what the right answers are. We have some ideas. We have two political parties. They have their ideas about it. The truth is, it goes back and forth and back and forth. Just like me, I make mistakes through the course of my life. Hopefully, I take that information to take another step forward. I'm praying that that's what we can do in our democracy, as well as what we can do personally in our emotional sobriety. So I am praying for emotional sobriety for our whole United States. You know, Bill Wilson said, you know, Herb, and you've made a point of this. This way of life has value for all. It really does. And the principles we're talking about really give us a great way of showing up in life and not being managed by life, but learning how to manage life, not by controlling it, but by accepting it as it is and learning how to cope with that reality.
Yeah.
So that's been a big change, man. I mean, I swear, I get goosebumps thinking about it. I mean, you know, I was at Little Young Turk before and trying to twist and make everything go my way. I mean, Herb remembers me back then, man. I was, you know, one of the powerhouse therapists that would step in and try to, you know, force a square peg in a round hole. And look, I learned a lot from that. I mean, I developed some pretty good skills in terms of sometimes somebody might need to be confronted. But boy, the other thing that I see with this emotional sobriety is that the broader, the wider, the more possibilities I have in how I respond to a situation, the better I can respond to a situation because I can be flexible. if something's not working, I can try something else.
Yeah. Well, you said you learn. Well, I learned that a square and a circle are not the same thing. And
I didn't figure that out. And
there's not a thing I'm going to do to change those those are two things. And I need. And so what did you learn? You learned discernment. You know,
we part of emotional sobriety is this discernment.
You said a sentence in there there's so many things that are at the very core of this. Everything is an opportunity is what you said. And that's exactly right. Everything is an opportunity. I've grown up making exceptions. You know, when the big shit hits the fan, traditionally through our culture, I can deal with problems with all kinds of things with my spiritual principles or my recovery principles, but no, this has to do with money. So none of this applies all of a sudden. It's like it's a whole different matter. It's like, no, it applies especially. I just love that everything is an opportunity, what you said.
One of the keys, Alan, that you mentioned a phrase, and I'm going to expand on it a little bit. You talked about in a sentence, and I won't repeat the sentence, but you used the phrase, my reality. And it struck me, the simple emotional sobriety formula is that my reality is as close to reality itself as possible. Consciousness here is the key, I believe. Consciousness is the key to be aware of any time that I'm disturbed, I'm out of alignment with reality. My reality and reality are at counterpoints. And if I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me. Yeah. There's something amiss with me. There's something out of alignment with me. I need to take responsibility to align with reality, because reality never, 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 never changes. It just grinds slowly forward in evolution. And I need to perceive it correctly, respond to it correctly, act correctly, and find those principles. That's where Bill had it totally right. Practice these principles in all our affairs. And in the after the ninth step, he says we enter the world of the spirit, meaning consciousness itself, and we grow in understanding and effectiveness, and we practice that course correction in step 10 whenever it happens. He calls it on the spot, and in the morning and in the evening we get a bigger picture as to how did we do and how can we do better tomorrow. Consciousness, what are the principles? The language I use with the guys I work with is identify the principle. What's the underlying principle? Always make your decisions on principle. Always take the high road. Always take the high road and always be generous.
Yeah.
If you operate on principle, take the high road and be generous, your life will work eventually, not maybe immediately, but eventually. And they say to me, do I always have to operate on principle and take the high road and be generous? I go, absolutely not. But you always have to live with the consequences.
Right.
Well, see, that's where we talk about letting the best of you do the talking for the rest of you, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's exactly the thing that we strive for. And look, we all have experienced, and that we know is that we all that's a goal to strive for. But we strive for progress towards that goal. We're not going to pull that off perfectly. And because there's a lesson every time you fall short. You know, there's so much information to unpack to help you grow and take the next step. And that's the other thing, is that this is alchemy, right? I know you've used that term before, and I have too. It's how do you turn lead into gold? Well, come to emotional sobriety. You will learn how to do that. You will learn how to take something that is baffling you, you know, is crushing you, that is terrible for you, and find some way of processing it to grow yourself from it. Today, we call it post-traumatic growth. Right, post-traumatic growth instead of traumatic stress.
Yeah. There's a lot of that out there, but we could take that stress and turn it into growth. In fact, the most recent American Psychological Association, for one of the journals, has dedicated the whole journal to articles about post-traumatic growth. I mean, it's really, we're swinging around right now, and we're starting to recognize that it's not what's happening to you that's the issue. It's your relationship to it and how you
do. Bill wrote the big book in his early recovery. He was 5 years sober. He wrote the 12 and 12, 20 years after he got sober, approximately. And in the 12 and 12, he uses the term emotional sobriety. Because it took that long for him to thaw out sufficiently for him to know that, oh, that's an issue. And he calls it the next frontier. At 20 years of sobriety, he calls it the next frontier. Now, of course, it didn't happen that way because the world wasn't ready for it. But that, I mean, from my standpoint, and you've said it, Alan, you've summarized it this way, and I think it's a wonderful kind of a cap on this, is steps 1 through 9 gives us physical sobriety, a program of recovery. 10, 11, and 12 gives us emotional sobriety. We live in the world of spirit in that fourth dimension that you mentioned, and we grow in understanding, consciousness, and effectiveness, contribution. From my standpoint, it's just like, oh my God, that's so perfect.
Well, it's a great way to say it, because that 1 through 9 is really laying a foundation for emotional sobriety. It's laying a foundation of physical sobriety and also self-awareness. I mean, and responsibility, developing a strong, strong self-discipline that is the core of that is self-responsibility.
Well, I'm going to say it a little differently, because you come from the psychological standpoint. I come from a theological standpoint. It develops a consciousness with connection with power, and not so much self-discipline as it is a connection, the power that allows me to manage my life.
Yeah.
It gives me the power of consciousness to manage my life.
He said, willpower gets a bad rap in our program. Yeah. And he wrote a whole thing on it in this Language of the Heart, with a collection of his stuff. He says, it's true. Willpower applied to the wrong issue is not going to work. He says, using willpower to try to stop yourself drinking, it doesn't work. But using your willpower to create a discipline of working the steps, he says, it's a wonderful use of that willpower, is for us to make that choice. And that's where step 3 comes in. You've emphasized over and over again how we make a decision.
Yeah. To be in alignment with reality.
And see, we didn't do it before. We just went along and lived our life, thought it would somehow fall in place. I mean, it was so happenstance, wasn't it?
Right. Well, unfortunately, human beings can make a religion out of anything. Yeah. And Bill created a spirituality, a way of life. Yeah. The easier, softer way is to do the rituals and not have the transformation.
Yeah, right on.
All I'll add is there's a line that stood out from what you were saying, Alan, about if we don't focus on this, it doesn't just happen. Locating where I've come to is locating the terrain inside myself. I get told sometimes I have bad boundaries with other people, and I've talked to you about boundaries, Alan, and I've been very persuaded by the idea that boundaries applied to the world outside myself are unenforceable. and so if the work can become, how do I grapple and, make decisions within that slipstream, of like this narrow band that I can where I have some agency. Ooh. And kind of like find a way to live in the world in a healthy way. And like Herb says, in alignment with reality, then that's a road to wellness.
Well, that's what the Serenity Prayer calls the road of wisdom.
I'm early, but I'm working with guys now, and I just like the way I look at myself isn't as sober or not sober. It's as like I began at a place of thorough illness, you know, just like physical addiction. And I was on a bunch of stuff, and I was my ideas were really shitty, and I was just very just laced with toxicity. And then
you were thoroughly ill. I love that.
Ill. Yeah. And then each year I'm the goal is to become less and less ill and more healthy. And I just love the disentangling, you know, the happiness from this equation because that's going to come and go. That's not a good marker for how I'm doing exactly, though. I like to be happy all the time. That'll always be kind of like my preference. I don't need to be okay.
The key is really to define what is happiness.
Yeah, and I like yours. I'm going to steal it. Well, thanks so much, guys, for sitting down today and rapping a bit.
Thank you.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.